This is the Fatty Joe Show, coming to you from Casa de Carey, deep in the forests of Nutmeggerville. This show is dedicated to exploring pathways to better health from a holistic perspective. In each episode, we will explore such topics as nutrition, mental and emotional health, fitness, and more. I'm Yogi, your host. And I became interested in studying health after conventional health dogma became damaging and led me to become massively overweight. Against modern convention, I went on a keto lifestyle and I lost over 300 pounds and gained a level of control on my personal health that I never had before. Now I'm on a journey to find out what is myth and what is truth in the ever-convoluted world of what is considered healthy. Come join me on a journey of discovery as I look for a path to improve total health. If you'd like to support the show, head over to patreon.com/thefattyjoeshow or patreon.com/carriebrown. If you want to check out all of our social media links and recipes, head to carriebrown.com. Don't forget to leave a comment, like, and subscribe to the show.
Everybody, and welcome to the Fatty Joe Show. Today we have a special guest, keto coach Jessica. Jessica is a life coach and a ketogenic lifestyle coach who is certified with holistic nutrition, LCF HF nutrition, and cognitive behavioral therapy for eating disorders. She struggled with bulimia, anorexia, and compulsion for eating for 31 years before discovering keto. She has now been in recovery for over 4.5 years and has spent most of her time spreading the word that there is hope, healing, and recovery from eating disorders and mental illnesses by just eating real food. She has worked with hundreds of clients over the last 3.5 years to help them break free. She has also lost 141 pounds, got off her meds and depressions, bipolar disorder, anxiety, bladder disease, migraine, OCD, traumatic brain injury from electric shock therapy, all by eating a well-formulated ketogenic diet. Jessica's entire family lives on the keto lifestyle, including her 13-year-old daughter, who has managed her epilepsy with keto for the last 4 years. And that is amazing. You've also been featured in Women's First, First for Women and Women's World magazines. And in, you've spoke on several podcasts, 11 podcasts, and the Low Carb Cruise, the Keto Con, and you're an upcoming speaker for the Low Carb Cruise and Keto Con 2021. That is some amazing stuff, lady. You are like out there just totally kicking butt.
You know what? It's just life. When I hear it, it sounds like, who is he talking about? Now I realize it's me. It's very humbling, though, to remember that just 5 years ago, I was a completely different person. Yeah. And you can never lose sight of that. I'm blessed to be able to tell my story a lot, but I stay very, very close to where I came from.
Yeah. What brought you to the keto lifestyle? Like, what was the first light that rung that this might help you for your...
Well, I had basically my health. I had gotten to 309 pounds. I hadn't left the house in, you know, really 5 years, occasionally for a doctor's appointment, like for therapy or something like that. But I really had gotten to the point I was so depressed. I was suicidal. I binged and purged all day or just binge ate. 309 pounds, and I wasn't leaving the house. And I stopped caring about life. I could not be a good mom. I could not be a good wife. And I definitely could not be a good friend to anyone. I was off social media. It's like I fell off the face of the earth. And I had never quite been that heavy before. I had gained and lost and gained and lost. I'd had a low of 115 pounds and a high of 309. So I mean, I was all over the place, but I'd never quite been this big. And I got to the point where at night, it was really hard for me to breathe. I would wake up gasping for air. If I would do something, even try to do something physical, like walk up or down the steps, or even if I had, if I laughed or sneezed, like it would act, I would see stars. There was like a tunnel, like I would almost pass out. So I avoided medical doctors. I was going to therapy some, but I avoided medical doctors because I did not want to be judged for my weight. I did not want to be told that I needed to lose. I had already tried everything. I've literally been on every diet since 11 years old, every diet. And there's nothing that I hadn't done. So I was just sort of resigned to the fact I am meant to be fat. I'm going to get bigger and bigger, and I'm going to die in my house. And I'm going to be one of those people they have to, like, you know, take out the door to take me out. And I don't want to say I was at peace with it, but I just had accepted that's how it was going to be. There was no coming back from that. I was too far gone. And my husband, we've been married for a really long time. When he realized really how bad things were with my health, he basically said, I can't make you go to the doctor, but will you please go and get your blood pressure taken? I'm just really worried, like, you're going to die. And at that point, I was like, I don't care. So I went out and I got my blood pressure taken by at a little clinic, like a pharmacist was there. And I looked down at the light where it flashes what your blood pressure is. And it was so high. And I've never given two thoughts to blood pressure my entire life. But right beside of the number, the crazy high number was something like immediate risk for heart attack and stroke. And right in that minute, I was like, I really could have a stroke just any second. And instead of like my past flashing before my eyes, my future flashed before my eyes. I started to think about my older daughter getting married, and I pictured myself, these are really vivid pictures, but I pictured myself sitting there sort of messed up in a wheelchair having had a stroke. It was me, but I was really messed up. And then I pictured myself not being there for my younger daughter's graduation. It's like I started to actually mourn the things I wouldn't be present for. And that's the first time I had really thought about that. I'm not going to be in my children's future. I literally flashed for a second on the fact of Mike having a different wife. And I don't want that. I want it to be me. But I was so stuck where I was. I didn't admit until that moment, I am robbing myself of any possibility of being in my family's lives in the future. So that day, right after that, my husband said, we have to do something. He had gained weight with me, wasn't as bad. We'd always been partners in crime. We lost and gained together. So we were fat and skinny many, many, many times together. This time I had just passed him and just gone on and on and on. But he said, well, you know what? We lost weight on Atkins before, and we could still eat a lot of food. So let's just do that. And I remember the first thing that I got, because I didn't know anything about keto. Again, this was getting close to 5 years ago. We went by Chick-fil-A and got a 30-piece nugget because I knew that each nugget was like 1 gram of carbs, and I'd probably been eating, you know, 1,000 grams of carbs a day. So I'm like, yes. So I ate a 30-piece nugget, and I was like, yes, I'm low carb again. And even with that really sloppy, lower carb eating, I started to lose some weight. Well, my husband was on social media, and like I said, I had disappeared. I had deactivated everything, and he said, I'm going to add you to some low-carb groups so you can get some ideas on food, get inspired, and he ran across Ketogenic Success, and he added me to that group, and I started to learn more. I started to see people's before and after pictures. And I was like, something's different about this. This is not what I'm doing. and it sort of sent me down the rabbit hole of studying nutrition. But I wanted to know what was different. I'm like, this is not Atkins. There's this there was all this fat, you know, and for me, I'm 46 years old. I was raised in a fat is bad, anti-fat. I mean, I went whole years of my life and only ate 20 grams of fat a day. But I started to listen to that. I started to study it. I started to read books. And during this time, I'm feeling better and better and better. And so that's sort of what got me there. And from there, I've just continued to study, continued to live the lifestyle. Within 2 months, I was feeling so much better that I was not binging and purging. And for me, that was a huge deal because I had been bulimic since age 11. I mean, even at 309 pounds, I still binged and purged. I just binged a lot more than I purged. So that was a big thing, but I felt some mental clarity that I had never felt before. And that was what was different. It's not like keto fixed everything, but it cleared my mind in a way that it had never been before. So I could actually think, could think through my own behaviors. I could use therapy that I'd had for years that I just thought didn't apply to me. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing that fat will fuel the brain and help the brain function a lot more. I know one of the reasons why I went on keto wasn't to lose weight. I didn't think it would happen, but I was having symptoms that were very similar to CTE. And so that was my choice to go on. And then the weight loss was a side effect. And I've really seen that. And you also use, your daughter has epilepsy and you use keto to treat epilepsy. And we know that that was an old treatment for epilepsy that kind of went away and is now starting making a comeback through programs like the Charlie Foundation. Right. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I am so proud of her. She's amazing. And of course, I'm saying that she's my kid, but she just really, truly is. She inspires me. I use her for an example all the time. When people say, I can't do keto here or there, or this is too hard, or my situation is too much pressure, I say, my 13-year-old daughter has done keto for 4 years and never cheated, never. And she goes to school parties and sleepovers and camp and everything like that. I'm pretty sure you can do it as an adult. And so I remember that for myself, but I also talk to other people about that. It can be done if you have a good enough reason. And of course, her reason is she doesn't want to have seizures anymore. But I actually had not heard of keto for epilepsy. I also wasn't aware, I guess that you could tell that from my story, I wasn't aware that keto would do anything for you other than help you lose weight. So all the side effects, the I'm not purging, this is crazy, I'm feeling better, I'm not depressed, that was a shock to me. I had no idea. And there's a lot more information out there now, but I had not heard of keto for epilepsy. So I was already keto. My husband had gone full on keto, and we had changed Clara's diet some. She was lowish carb because, again, studying nutrition, I couldn't in good conscience give her the stuff that I used to give her. But she was still low carb. You know, we switched out. We got low carb wraps instead of bread, and we had already made that transition. But it happened that I learned about keto for epilepsy at her neurologist's office. There was a sign up for the Charlie Foundation, and it talked about a ketogenic diet for epilepsy. We were already keto. I did not know this. So that made me look it up and study and find out. And when it came right down to it, I remember us sitting her down and saying, Clara, we know this is going to be hard, but we can't know something that might help you not have seizures and not do it. If it doesn't work, we'll go back to the way things were. But if we know this might help and we don't do it, we would be really bad parents. And she was not thrilled about it. A lot of parents say, well, how do I get my kid to do keto? Well, we buy the food. And I did try to make sure she had enjoyable things. I made Carrie's ice cream a lot. I did try to keep it fun for her, especially in the beginning. And she did it, and she started to feel better, and she had been on 6 pills a day, and over that first year, she got all the way down to just 2, and then after another 6 months, she got down to like 1/4 of 1 dose, and that's what she takes today. But So she still has epilepsy. They can still see her seizures when they do an EEG, but she doesn't have seizures. She just doesn't have them. And before, she had breakthrough seizures, even on 6 pills. And so it really is amazing. And again, to navigate it with her makes me know certainly I can always do it. There's no situation where I have to compromise. She can't compromise. So that means I don't have to. And that also means anyone else can do it. I don't believe there's a situation where you have to compromise your health. And if you have a reason as good as epilepsy, it makes it a lot easier. But for me, my reason is I never want to go back to the person that I was.
Yeah, it's once you've experienced a lot of the health benefits that keto brings, it's really hard to backpedal. I know some people do, but it seems like the people that have experienced health benefits outside of the realm of just fat loss, really, that's the people that really gets glued into it. You work with her on epilepsy. About what age was she when you first started seeing her having seizures? And did she get the full grand mal seizures or?
She was in kindergarten. So she was about 5 when she started to have seizures. At first, we didn't really know what was going on because she has both types of seizures. The first one, we realized she had an absence seizure and she was completely absent, just like frozen, no movement, no response, which was really, really scary. And then a couple months later, they had thought, well, maybe it was a one-time occurrence. And then 2 months later, she had a very terrible seizure. She almost died. It's one of those moments in time that you never forget. But yeah, she started seizing and foam and blood came out of her mouth. And I remember I was so scared. I called, you know, emergency services, and I was relieved. They got there really fast. I was relieved when they showed up, but then they started working on her and I could tell by their faces and the way they were looking at each other that there was no relief. Like nothing was happening. It was not improving. And I remember jumping in the ambulance with them and we were racing to the hospital and we stopped at a light. And I guess they had called a doctor to meet us en route and he parked his car in a parking lot and jumped on the ambulance with us. So this was urgent. And they started talking about her oxygen levels. And I think I was just kind of frozen. Like I could hear what was being said, but they started talking about not being able to get her oxygen going. And the doctor said he couldn't either. And so this was it was a moment that I think changed my life. It took away the safety of life. It kind of sent me down a spiral when I think about the timing. As I mentioned, I went into a deep, deep, deep depression. I was on a lot of pills, eventually resorted to electric shock therapy, which was terrible. But this was part of it. I didn't sleep anymore. I kept being afraid that something was going to happen. I wouldn't be awake for it and I would lose her. But it kind of started a spiral. So she was in the hospital for a while. They diagnosed her with epilepsy. At that time, they had thought it was childhood epilepsy and she would grow out of it. Now we know that's not the case. She will have epilepsy. So she'll need to eat this way her whole life. But yeah, that's been a life-changing part of this for us. And I feel like I would have maintained keto even if it weren't for that. But talk about incentive. You know, yeah. I have to show her it can be done. And she shows me it can be done. And as a family, we do this together, you know?
Yeah, I've been reading a little bit about keto and brain health since I've started. And one of the things that I've seen is that a lot of people that are suffering from either epilepsy or traumatic brain injury, that is a case where people a lot of times really do try to chase the ketones for a beneficial way and raise those ketones really high. So they may do a lot of MCT. They may do a lot of even exogenous ketones. What is the diet for your daughter? How do you formulate that? What does that look like?
It's changed a little bit over time. She eats pretty much intuitively now. We pay attention to it, but after 4 years, she knows what she's doing. We don't have to be super involved. but she eats a very, very high fat diet. I lost that 143 pounds eating an extremely high fat diet, which seems to be controversial somehow, because I keep hearing you can't lose fat if you eat fat, but I ate all the fat and lost a lot of fat. So if that's true, then my story can't exist. So for some people, that's not true, but for her, she's needed that. And I think I need it for my brain health. The high fat is not just about satisfaction for us. We eat a lot of butter. We eat a lot of, you know, healthy oils, avocados. The way that we eat is we look at whatever we have, whether it's a protein source or if it's a healthy carbohydrate like green leafy vegetables or cheese or nuts. Anyway, we look at that and we say, how can I add fat to this? And that's how we keep the percentage up around 85-90. We don't track anymore. I never tracked through my entire keto journey because I needed freedom. I was obsessed with numbers. I couldn't do it. So I think that's a big part of my story. For her, we were very, very careful. But at this point, we don't track. She knows what super high fat looks like. And we literally say, how can I make this a vehicle for fat? And we try to add two fats to everything. And so it's really like, it's that. So if we have ground beef and we've added, you know, Mexican seasoning, then we're like, how can we add fat to it? And we add guacamole and sour cream, you know? So it's really just, it's that easy. And, you know, it's not something we think about a lot now. She makes her own food. I hear her in there cooking. And if she makes two eggs, she's going to do 2 tablespoons of butter. She knows that. So it is our lifestyle.
Yeah. So is there, dude mentioned butter and avocado. Is there other types of fat that you guys target for brain health? Do you guys look into like eating more fish for omega-3s or, yes, or anything like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, salmon is a regular in our diet. Interestingly enough, I hated salmon, but while I was pregnant with her, I read that if you eat salmon in the third trimester, it will help your baby's brain. So I learned to like it for that reason. But yeah, now it is a regular in both of our diets. And so yes, we do that. We do, I don't really do MCT oil anymore. I used to back in the beginning. I feel really good without it. I guess being fat adapted, I don't need it as much. But we do coconut oil, avocado oil, things like that also.
Have you guys ever tried anything like C8 MCT oil?
I'm not sure.
Because one thing about the C8 MCT oil is it converts incredibly easy to ketones. It's one of the easiest forms. There is an easier form than the C6, but apparently it tastes horrible and there's no way they can make it taste better. So the C8 form actually converts pretty much as soon as you put it in the mouth, it starts converting into ketones, almost like sugar does. And I was reading, it was an article from the Charlie Foundation about a young boy that had severe epilepsy, and he was even tough to manage it under keto. And that was one of the things that they introduced to this kid that actually helped him stabilize off. And then I think they went with CBD as well, that helped calm the seizures.
Yeah, we do. We have tried CBD also. She also has migraines. It's related to the seizure activity. And we've used that with success for that. But yeah, we tend to run very high in ketones. Look at it like it's the replacement for the 17 pills that I used to take for, you know, mostly mental health illnesses. And I'm off those. So for me, high fat is my medicine.
Yeah. And let's talk about the mental health side as well, because that's one thing that Carrie cured with the keto diet was, not cured, but put in remission. And it was, she suffered from bipolar. And when she told Dr. Ted Naiman, I take these meds, I suffer from bipolar, Ted intuitively looked at the meds and they happened to be the same meds you would treat for epilepsy.
Right.
A lot of them. And so he put her on a keto diet. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what you were going through with the depression and the meds that you were taking. Maybe can you tell us like how the meds made you feel before you went on keto and tell us a little bit about that.
So I had so many diagnoses, and I won't say, I think they're all accurate. OCD, bipolar disorder, severe depression, anxiety, agoraphobia at one point, because I wouldn't even walk outside. It wasn't like I was, it wasn't social phobia. It wasn't about being around people. I wouldn't go outside. I only felt safe in my house. So I had a lot going on. I had some medical issues too, but in terms of mental stuff, I was really messed up. The problem is, I think I started taking meds for depression in my teens. The first time I went to an eating disorder hospital, they also said, well, you're really depressed too. And they started me on Prozac. So I really stayed on meds from the time I was 16 until when I found keto, I was 41. So I had many, 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 many years of meds. And like Carrie, I know she was on Lamictal. I was also, so was Clara. And again, same meds for seizures and bipolar disorder, but I took all of them. I mean, from lithium to, I mean, literally every drug that you can be given for bipolar or depression, I tried it. Someone can bring up a med now unless it's something brand new. And I'm like, yes, and that's how this works. And here's the side effects. I wish I didn't know so much, but it's from personal experience. I was just never okay. And I was really good at, I did function in life. I had jobs, but I would go out into the world and do my work, put on the mask, and then come back to a hotel room by myself, fall to pieces, cry, order everything on the room service menu, binge, purge, and then go back and do it the next day. And there was a point I got to where I couldn't do that anymore. I walked away from a very, very successful career and just could not do it. That's how bad it got. But I was in a place where I had extreme highs and extreme lows. And in those extreme lows, I really struggled with suicidal ideation. A thought would get into my mind like, you should do this to yourself. You should cut your wrist. And I would picture myself doing it. And at that moment, I don't think I really wanted to die, but I could not stop that compulsive thought, which is part of the OCD. It was depression plus OCD. And I can remember days of laying on the couch on my hands for 8 hours till my husband got home, because I was so afraid if I got up, I was going to follow through just to make that voice in my head stop. It was bad. It was really, really bad. And at some point, again, I was maxed out on pills. There's nothing else. There was nothing else they could do. And my doctor said, well, there's nothing else we can give you. We think the only option for you is electric shock therapy. Now, I'm not someone who realized that was even a thing still. So I was desperate. And obviously, I wasn't even in my right mind. I just was like, I'll do anything. That wound up being rough. That was a huge mistake. I did 12 sessions of that, and it wiped out whole chunks of time for me. I actually did have a brain injury. Like, for about a year and a half, I could not write my name. I get confused about like what year it was. And those chunks of memory that are lost, they're gone. I had to go through like the stages of grief and just mourn. I don't remember whole years. My husband and I went to Jamaica, and I know that because I've seen pictures. Zero memory. I mean, I would promise you with every breath in my being that I'd never been there, except for I've got pictures to prove it. So it's big. It really, really messed up my brain. And if it gave any relief, it was so temporary that I don't remember that either. In the end of it, I was worse than ever. And I wound up getting back on all the meds, more suicidal because my brain was all messed up and it was confusing. And I had always considered myself pretty smart. And after that, I felt dumb. I couldn't keep a conversation. I would say a few words and then trail off, and I couldn't remember what was going on. It was just very bizarre. So I was in a really low place. When I say I was low, I mean, I don't know how you can be any lower and be alive. But I was at that place where I just wish something would happen to me. I was like, I wish I would walk outside and get hit by a car and die. I mean, it's terrible, but that's how I felt. I hoped for that. And that's why I didn't care anymore. It's literally like, fine, you know, I give up. I'm not fighting my eating disorder. I'm not fighting the depression. I accept this is just who I am. And the biggest problem with that is it's such a huge lie. You think if I stop fighting the stuff, I'll finally have peace. But it was quite the opposite. When you stop fighting your mental illness and you stop fighting the eating disorder, it takes over your life completely. If you thought things were bad before you stopped fighting, oh my gosh, you lose yourself. And that's what happened to me. I was lost completely, just a complete wreck, just existing, not living. So again, I mean, it became about my health, and my husband, you know, really got me on low carb, and him too, but it helping my mental health was a pleasant surprise. It was amazing. I just couldn't believe it. So all these years I was on meds, and then eating this way for a few months after, over the next year with my doctor's help, I was able to get off of the meds for all those things, the physical and the mental health thing.
I find it really difficult to fathom in this, our society today, that our doctors often jump to the most restrictive, the most invasive procedure to help people, when the least invasive procedure is to change the diet and the lifestyle. Right. I worked at group homes for many years, and I saw, because we had to medicate the kids, and I saw a lot of the side effects, the ODing on the meds as they build up in the system. And these things are harsh, and people don't realize how dangerous it is to play with brain chemistry that even the doctors don't quite understand yet.
Yeah, I felt like a zombie. It worked. It kept me, the pills probably kept me alive. It kept me completely numbed down. I was so anxious. I think one of the things that sort of sent me in the house and not going out is I thought if I could just get away from everything that made me feel anxious, I would not feel that way. And after a while being at home, I realized I can't get away from it because it's inside of me. It's not an external cause. I have this horrific fear, this crushing fear, this anxiety that never goes away, and it's not related to anything I'm exposed to. And that was terrible because I was like, no, I can't ever get away from this. So I did have a bunch of meds, and some I took every single day, and then some I took as needed. But literally, they would hit me like a tranquilizer dart. Like, literally, I would like start to slobber. Like, I'm a bear that got hit with a tranquilizer dart and just fell out. So it kept me alive. It kept me from doing something crazy in that moment. But I wasn't living. It doesn't just numb you to the pain or to the anxiety. It numbs you to happiness and joy. I just didn't feel. I just didn't. I literally just existed, and which is not living. The meds really did a number on me. The electric shock therapy did, you know, again, was barbaric. But here I am today anyway, restored. And I wouldn't say I'm actually restored. It's probably not the right word, because I'm not who I was. Those parts of me that were lost through that process, I did not recover. But I feel like in this healing process and healing my brain with the healthy fats and anti-inflammatory foods, I feel like parts of me that before were latent kind of lit up and took over and compensated for the parts that were lost.
Now you've taken all these experiences and you've decided to help others, and you've gotten certified as a coach in many different fields. Mm-hmm. One of the things you specialize in is working with people that had similar disorders when it came to their relationship with food that you had, the bulimia, the anorexia, and you also work with food addictions. So I want to ask you, let's break down a little bit about, because I don't think enough people talk about these conditions and actually what they are. Let's break these things down. Let's break down bulimia and anorexia first, and then we'll talk about food addiction after that.
Right. I think there's a general misperception about all of them. When people think eating disorder, they think anorexia or bulimia. They don't think binge eating disorder or compulsive eating, and they certainly are. They have just as much a hold on your life and can ruin you as much. And a lot of people like me cycle through different things. There were times in my life that I was severely anorexic, and there were times like bulimia was always there no matter what. And there were times that I just completely binge ate, you know, 10,000 calories in a short period of time. But so eating disorders are not just being thin and it's not being fat. There can be people who are overweight who don't have an eating disorder. They have just eaten poorly their whole life and eaten too much. Eating disorders are a mental issue. Anorexia is defined as, you know, losing so much weight that you are 20% below your body weight. And so from a physical standpoint, you see someone who's really thin. It's interesting because I struggled with that for so long. I can look at someone and tell if they're just a thin person or if they have an eating disorder every time. I can engage them in conversation. I'm always right. There is a hollowness, an emptiness in their eyes. And it's not just starving yourself. It really is just self-harm. You feel so angry. The world feels out of control and you just decide, I'm not eating. I control that 100%. When the pain comes, when the hunger pain comes in your stomach, you embrace it. I know it sounds sick, but it is. You actually are like, I deserve this pain. It feels good. So it is self-harm. And it's a really, really deep thing, and it's not just about the food. You can change the food, but if you don't address why the person's doing it, they will go back to it. And I did every single time. Like I said, I was in like 5 eating disorder hospitals, had more therapists than I can count. None of that did anything until I fixed my food. So it has to be both. The biggest misconception, I think, is bulimia. When people hear bulimia, they think you eat and you throw up, which is true. But bulimia actually is anything that you do to purge your body of calories or to undo an eating event after you've done it. So you can have bulimia and not purge, but take laxatives. I used to take hands full of laxatives. Sometimes it was purging, sometimes it was both, but you would take laxatives to try to empty your body out of the food that you ate. You can actually purge your body by over exercising. You can say, oh man, I ate something I shouldn't have. I'm going to, you know, this many calories, I'm going to make sure I exercise this much to get rid of that. It's almost a bulimic mindset. And a lot of people, when I talk to them and I ask them, you know, have you ever struggled with bulimia? And they say, no. And then I'll start talking about those things. They're like, oh, I've done that. I've taken the laxatives and diuretics to try to get rid of the bloat from the food that I ate or try to undo that eating decision. I think that's what it is. So bulimia, in my estimation, is anything that you do to undo a food decision that you made. And I think that's really important. A lot more people struggle with it than they even realize.
These behaviors can really cause a lot of damage to the internal systems of the body, though, can't they?
That's right. I still struggle, even though I've been keto going on 5 years, I struggle with IBS because, I mean, there was a point I was taking 77 laxatives a day. I mean, it was just boxes and boxes of them. I would eat food and immediately it would leave me. Like, how messed up does your system have to be for food to go from your lips into the toilet? I mean, really, it's really messed up. So I still struggle with IBS because now I won't take them for anything. And I know that's healing and it's better than it was, but I really struggle with IBS with constipation. It was caused by laxative abuse. But yeah, I had some really bad, my back teeth got all rotted out, and I'd always been really proud of my teeth, and I was 26 and I'd never had a cavity, but in my 20s the bulimia got so much worse that, I mean, I just, like, my back teeth all had to come out. It was bad. Mm-hmm. And it messes with your head too. I think the worst thing about bulimia is it feels so disgusting that if you're someone who has it, it is a secret. You do not ever let anybody know this is something you do, because, and then of course that makes you walk around feeling like you're a fraud. Like, if people knew who I really was, if they knew what I did behind closed doors, they would think so much less of me. This is a dirty secret, but I can't stop doing it. Bulimia makes you manipulate people. I hope there's someone that's going to be listening to this that can relate and realize they're not by themselves, because it's not talked about. Everybody thinks they're alone. But you manipulate people. You get people that you really love spending time around to leave. You want them to leave because all you can think about is binging and purging, and you can't do it in their presence. And so it really messes with your mind. It really screws with your self-esteem. And you do walk around all the time feeling like a complete fraud. If someone gives you a compliment, if someone thinks well of you, all you can think is they don't really know me. And that's a tortured life. I lived it for decades. I mean, literally, the first time I threw up was 11, and then, you know, I stopped at 41. So decades of my life, I felt like a fraud.
The question I was asking is, there's a lot of gender bias associating with this these eating disorders, isn't there? The common misperception, the myth, is that these are female eating disorders, but really this is a human eating disorder.
It really is. And like I said, there's already just so much shame wrapped up in it. You feel like you're the only one. And so it's hard for a woman to admit that she has it. She hides it. I've had clients who have been bulimic for 20 years and been married and never told their husbands. They still hide it from them. I mean, this person knows everything about them and they hide that. So it's hard for anybody to talk about. But again, I think for men, it feels especially wrong. And in my experience in eating disorder hospitals, it was normally like all women and one man. The ratio of people that were there. And I don't think that men actually have it less. In my experience with coaching men, it eventually comes out. In the beginning, it's like denial, denial, denial. And then when we start to talk about some of their, when it really comes down to their specific behaviors around food, they're out of control. And when we really dig into why, it's emotional eating, if they're trying to soothe, you know, pain from childhood, there's an extraordinary amount of men who have eating disorders who are sexually abused as children. And things like that often come out. Because when you stop using the food to push that down for so many years, you start to remember. And that's hard. And a lot of people go back because they don't want to feel that. But I believe that men have eating disorders as often as women. I've definitely known a lot of men to have bulimia, known a couple of guys to have anorexia, but many, many men and women have binge eating disorder. When my parents first tried to get me help for my eating disorder, binge eating disorder wasn't acknowledged as an eating disorder, but compulsive overeating was. And I think they're slightly different. Compulsive overeating is I start eating and I can't stop. It may not be like a huge amount of food, but I don't have a signal that says you're full. So compulsive overeating can be eating, you know, everybody else can stop when they're full. I don't really have that point. Binge eating disorder is eating thousands of calories, a huge amount of food in a short period of time. I've done that too. I mean, I've done all those things. I was definitely eating. I was into binge eating when I got up to my highest weight. And a lot of men have binge eating disorder. And the problem with that is it's rooted in trying to solve a non-food issue with food. It's like, how quick can I push this down so I don't have to feel it? And if you always use food, and most people, it's rooted in childhood. I know for me, my eating issues went back to at least age 4. It's rooted in childhood stuff. And if every time you felt fear, you used food to soothe it, or every time you were ashamed, you used food to soothe that feeling, or every time you got hurt, sometimes this was nurtured by a parent or grandparents. Every time you got hurt, here, have this food. It'll make you feel better. By the time you get to be an adult, all those impulses start to feel like hunger. So if I'm afraid, I don't even know that it's fear anymore. All I know is I feel intensely hungry because that's my body trying to protect me from feeling fear. Do the thing you always do. So it can be very, very confusing. And the men, I know a lot of the ones that I've worked with, they're hesitant to talk about their feelings. And they really have to get to a place where they are trusting and that they are willing to go wherever it needs to go in order to get to the bottom of why they do what they do. But I think in men, it's more underreported than in women, and it's underreported in women. So it's a way bigger problem than people realize.
Yeah, I mean, underreporting is a common thing because of the fear of the backlash. In our society, we victim blame quite a bit. And there's always the fear of backlash of how you're going to be perceived. For men, oftentimes it's a view of weakness.
Yes.
And for women, it's usually somehow being excluded from their groups, being viewed differently, many other issues as well. But a lot of what you're describing is very, very much an allegory to why people self-medicate with drugs. It's the same kind of thing. And it's very challenging to overcome that when people are afraid to talk about it.
Well, it's challenging to overcome also because the problem that is really an issue here is people deny food addiction. I've literally every single day of my life on Instagram, I see people say there's no such thing as food addiction. You can't be addicted to something that you need. And I'm like, oh, that's just so wrong. For those of us who are addicted, we know that it has controlled our lives every bit as much as people who are addicted to alcohol or drugs. The problem with it is also that it's socially acceptable in most circles to show up and overeat. Nobody says anything. If you show up drunk, they say you have a problem. So it's one of those, it's socially accepted, and there's deniers of it. And there's people that say, well, you can be addicted to carbs, but not food. And I say, no way, that's not true. When I did Atkins back in the 90s, I would binge eat like packs and packs of hot dogs. I mean, I wasn't concerned about ingredients at that point because Atkins was mostly just like low carb. It wasn't super ingredient focused, but I could eat a whole roast. I mean, it didn't matter to me that it wasn't carbs. I still binge ate it because I was using it to stuff everything down. And then of course, purging, the relief of purging, and feeling like you released that emotion for a little while. But there are people who, part of the reason I never got well, and people ask me this question, like one of the first things they ask me all the time is, what was different about keto and the treatment that you got versus now? Because like I said, I've been in all the eating disorder hospitals, all the therapists, I literally can't remember them all. And for one thing, my brain was fat starved. So I could not think clearly. And I now know that my brain thrives on fat. So my brain was fat starved. I was in a carb coma. But the other thing is the approach that was taken. So we were always taught in therapy, eating disorder hospitals, that you know you're well when you can eat all things in moderation. And so that was always my goal. And every single time, the minute that I added sugar and bread and stuff like that back to my life, I relapsed. But I didn't understand why. I thought it was just me. And what I realize now is that the goal was wrong. What I know is this, and again, controversial, but I know this. There are people who can moderate and there are people who can't. And sort of proof of that is, you know, someone who is a moderator doesn't have to try to be. They don't have to work at it. They just are. They take up one bite of something and they're like, oh, that's rich. I couldn't eat another bite. And here I am and others like me over here eating all of them and wanting to take theirs that only has one bite out of and eat it too. You can't become that. You are or you aren't. And so for me, because it is food addiction, I have to use the same method that an alcoholic, that a drug addict uses, and that's sobriety. I have to get clean. My food has to stay clean. I have to keep my fat high for my brain, and I have to not eat foods that turn on inflammation or compulsive eating, and that's sugar and grains when it comes right down to it. And again, there are absolutely people out there that say, nope, you can be a moderator, but it's because they are. They cannot picture the hold that addiction has on someone when they're truly addicted. So, of course, they're coming from their viewpoint. I am a moderator. I was able to do this, but I'm not. And there's a lot of people just like me. And it's sort of a relief for a lot of people that they're not by themselves. They think they're the only one that it seems like everybody else can just, you know, figure it out and moderate. I'm like, no, there's a whole bunch of us. We just get shut down a lot.
You know, it's much like an addiction to a drug, I think people are more addicted to how they feel after they take it rather than actually addicted to the drug themselves. And if you look at what sugar does inside the body, it activates the same receptors that heroin does. And so it does give you this sense of euphoria. And it's hard to imagine why people wouldn't go, there's something here. This, the feeling that the people are getting from binge eating, from eating too many carbs or binge eating food in general, there is a euphoria. There's a relief that they're getting that they're addicted to this behavior. It's hard to imagine why people would deny such a thing.
I think a lot of times it's because it's a really hard, narrow road to say, I need to be food sober. Like the only real way to manage this forever and stay in recovery is to choose not to eat things that harm my body. That's what food sobriety means to me, by the way. I don't choose to eat things that harm my body, my mind, or my physical body. And the more I study nutrition, the more I'm able to identify what those things are. People don't want to think. I mean, really, think of, the world says there's no good foods and bad foods. A calorie is a calorie. And the truth is, sugar does something vastly different to your body, to your insulin, to your fat storage than butter. And so it does make a difference what you're eating. There are foods that are good for your body, meaning they produce good results. And there are foods that are bad, meaning they cause inflammation, which leads to disease. Someone, again, I've had this conversation with quite a few people in the community, and they say, well, it's not the food you're addicted to, it's the binging and the purging. And I said, well, then it's not the alcohol you're addicted to, it's just getting drunk. So either way, you have to eliminate the thing and work on the reasons why, too. Sobriety is what it takes for me. For people who are not moderators, we have to be abstainers. And most people go through anxiety when they realize they're not a moderator and never going to be. And they get angry and they say, it's not fair. I have to eat keto. Everybody else gets to eat this. They're getting away with it and I'm not. And I say, I am so grateful that I must be sober because of the need for me to not eat food that harms me, because those same foods turn on my eating disorder. I'm not going to have diabetes. I'm not going to have heart disease. My changing this to stay in recovery means that I am preventing disease, that those people that you think are getting away with eating those things are getting away. They're not. You know, foods affect your body, period. And so I'm actually saving myself from future health issues because I need to eat keto. So I don't feel like it's something that's thrust upon me. I think it's amazing to have found a way to recover from something that I didn't think was possible to recover from.
Yeah, it's, you hear very similar stories from anybody that's been addicted to anything. And it's always the feeling, yeah? And it's the same thing that people get when they're addicted to gambling. It's they addicted to this. There's a feeling that is brought on that makes you feel good or less pain in that moment. And I've been seeing research on opioids, mm-hmm. and how when you take the opium, you're not necessarily getting some eventually the pain relief you used to be able to getting.
Right.
But when you're without the opium, that pain that you would have is actually amplified,
right.
And so it just dulls it. So it takes something away. And that's why, one of the reasons why people get addicted is the opium actually creates like a phantom pain.
Right.
And I've experienced situations too with hunger when I was a larger person, where I would get times where not long after I ate, I was already hungry.
Yeah.
And I didn't need the calories, but like I was hungry. I could chew on the next thing I saw. And I imagine, work with a lot of people that are like that, and you see it firsthand quite a bit. So what are some of the things, some of the techniques that you use to help these people?
I run with another coach. We run food addiction recovery groups, and we have an 8-week agenda, and it really starts off with accepting that you aren't going to be a moderator. Like, it's not going to happen. You can't move forward with getting down to behaviors if you're still trying to use the thing that you're addicted to or the thing that turns on your addiction. And I think that's the first thing, is getting someone, helping them see. And we use examples from our own past, their own past. How many times have you said this was the last time, but you always do it again? I mean, at some point you have to say, all right, I've done that 1,000 times. If I've done this and I've done this diet and everything eventually fails, because I always say I am really good at losing weight, but I'm better at gaining it back. I did all the diets and I was successful. I didn't fail. I was successful until I wasn't. All that's proof that you can't maintain that lifestyle of being a moderator. So that's the first part. But the other thing is really helping people break down what is real hunger and what does it feel like compared to emotional hunger. Because I said, like I said, you know, if you've always used food to push down that anxiety feeling, the minute you have anxiety, it feels like crazy intense hunger. So we do work with people on that. I work with them individually because I do life coaching too. I coach eating disorders and keto coaching, and then I also do life coaching. And this is true about any repeated negative behavior in your life. You have to be able to, in the moment, say, is this real hunger or is it something else? It feels like hunger, but some of the questions you can ask yourself is, what are my thoughts right now? And a lot of times you find they're fear thoughts, and that's where anxiety is coming from. I'm afraid I'm going to look bad. I'm afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing. I'm afraid I'm about to get fired. Like, when you're having fear thoughts, those things are what's driving your hunger. The other easy thing that I tell people is, I handed you a bowl of plain ground beef and said, here you go, you're hungry, eat this. And you're like, no, that's not what I want. I want something crunchy, or I want something creamy. You're not really hungry. Because when you're truly, truly hungry, a bowl of beef will do it. So helping them learn the difference between, if I'm having a craving, that's not real hunger. That's an emotional need of some kind. So really separating, am I angry, anxious, am I lonely, am I tired? Because we try to fix tiredness by eating, just because we've done it so many times. But the only thing that will fix tiredness is rest. Eating is not going to make you less tired. It just isn't, probably more so. So it's helping them see that when they use food to solve emotional problems or physical problems like tiredness, and it's not real hunger, it doesn't fix the problem. And so it is, you know, it's not a quick thing. It's a journey. There is no magical thing, but there is, I think, a process that people work through that's proven to be successful. And it really is, it's separating real hunger from emotional hunger. It's acceptance, embracing, you know, different changes. It's realizing that no matter how many times you have repeated a behavior in your life and how comfortable it feels, if it doesn't serve you well for where you are now, you don't have to keep doing it just because you always did. And I think a lot of people are stuck on that. But I've always fill in the blank. Okay, maybe that protected you at one time. If you were abused, and abuse, childhood abuse is behind so much of this, but obesity and other things, but if you are abused, a lot of times people actually binge eat. They put on a layer of fat to protect them. They feel like someone won't want to touch them if they are unattractive or something like that. And I've heard that a lot. It's so frequent. It comes up. I can't even tell you how often it comes up in coaching constantly.
We had kids at the group home who would refuse to bathe themselves because they felt if they stink and they didn't look good, it would be a layer of protection. People wouldn't want to touch them, wouldn't want to hurt them. I've seen that firsthand. It's crazy how these early traumas, when you're, you know, vulnerable, if you don't have the power to stand up for yourself, that you'll create it some other way, and maybe not the best way for you.
Right. And that thought was, okay, at that time that protected me. Maybe people didn't mess with me as much when I got bigger or I smelled bad or whatever. But now here you are, you're an adult, you're tired. You want a relationship. You don't want to be rejected. You're not maybe, you know, it's realizing that just because I've always done that, I don't need it now as an adult. I don't need to protect myself in that way. I can do it in other ways. And it's finding that truth, I think, that lets people let go of things, behaviors too.
There's a lot of, right now, there's a lot of the memes going out about hashtag save the children and the, with the violence. And we talked earlier about being able to be comfortable to speak out, being able to comfortable to talk. And that's one of the reasons why these conditions go unnoticed for so long. And when you're abused as a child, oftentimes, you know, the old axiom was children should be seen and not heard. And the voice of these children have been taken away. And so that they're left in an unsafe environment, not able to talk about it. It has to manifest in when they get older in some of these things.
Yeah.
Because of growing up thinking you can't express yourself. You cannot advocate for your needs, your safety, your...
We talked about eating disorders being underreported. I am telling you, there is so much childhood abuse. I mean, I would say the percentage of people who have eating disorders or abuse as a child is at least 80. I started to see that when I was 18. I was in an eating disorder hospital, and literally like every person in the group besides me had been sexually abused. I was like, wow. So there is a very strong tie between that childhood thing and adult behaviors, adult obesity. And again, I started to see it back then, but now in what I do, it comes up very, very, very frequently. And I guess I feel very burdened, but also blessed to be someone that people finally get to say what they need to say to. You know, sometimes I'm the only one they've ever told. And I always encourage people to get therapy. I'm not a therapist. I'm a coach. But I do encourage people to go and get therapy, to go to a psychologist. But it starts with them telling someone. It starts with them saying, eating disorders, addiction, they thrive because they're secret. They thrive in the darkness. The minute somebody shines a little light on it and they tell me or they tell someone, that light makes that darkness back up just a little bit. And the more and more and more open that they are about it, and the less shame they feel, the less they need to cover it with the behaviors. So it's really, I mean, I feel like I get to see miracles happen all the time in my life, which is really cool, because 5 years ago, I thought I'd be dead any time. And now I get to experience people's miracles and be part of them. So it's pretty awesome life, actually.
That is amazing. As a mother yourself, and you've spoke about a lot of these eating disorders having their roots in childhood. So as a mother yourself, addressing other parents and guardians, what would you say to these parents to help them prevent their child from going down this route? What types of things can a parent or guardian do?
So there's a couple things. I don't think there's anything wrong with teaching your children about good nutrition when they're kids. You don't relate it to weight or anything else. You just teach them, like, sugar's not great for you. It's not about, you know, I've had the opportunity to go to Clara's school and actually talk to them about sugar and what happens in your body and inflammation. So I've been able to do it on that third grade level, you know, which is awesome. And guess what? They get it. A lot of those parents, some of them really love me and some of them really hate me, but they're like, my kid won't take a Capri Sun anymore. They want this. They understand. Kids understand a lot. And it's not about putting your thumb down, but it's saying, you know, it's better to eat this way. So starting off healthy is good. If I could go back in time and have Clara be healthy from the time she was born, I would do that. But the big thing is noticing your children. I think some of us are just wired a little bit differently when it comes to food. I know when I was 4, my mom took me to a child psychologist because I was writing my letters backwards. And she was a teacher. She thought I might have dyslexia. But I was 4. She took me to him and actually can remember going now. now that my mind's cleared, I remember so much stuff because I remember what he looked like. I described him, and it's spot on. So I remember him showing me a bunch of different pictures and having me write things. And my mom said when he came out and spoke to her, he said, you know what? There's nothing wrong with her. She's left-handed. That's why she's writing these things backwards. She's not dyslexic. She's very smart. But she's totally obsessed with food. At four years old. Already it was in my everything that I talked about was about food. Everything, you know, it's like he would have me tell stories and it was all about food. That was four. So I do think some of us, just like alcoholics, they get that first taste and they go crazy, and other people have a taste and they're like, oh, that's gross. And they have to like, it grows on them. Some of us are wired with that food thing. Notice your children. If they eat in secret, if they are, you notice that they eat normally in front of you and then they go in the refrigerator and they sneak and eat later. If you see them eat compulsively, like I see kids do this, you can tell they're not hungry, but they just eat compulsively. You have to start to talk about, how are you feeling? I think my compulsive eating became much, much worse when there were traumatic events that happened in my house that I witnessed. And again, I didn't remember those things till I was an adult, but it's really when it got worse. It's like every time that thought would pop in my head, that's when I would compulsively eat. I felt the need to eat to push that down. There's usually something behind it. It's not just a kid. I don't look at weight at all in this. I don't, because kids are made to be all different shapes and sizes. And, you know, we do have some control as parents over what we feed them. And, you know, you don't have to buy them junk. People say, but my kid would be mad at me if I buy this instead of this. I'm like, okay, but they'll get over it because they'll be hungry and they'll eat eventually. But I think it's not about weight. It's emotional stuff. We need to let our sons know it's okay to have feelings. We need to let our daughters know that if something's bothering them, they can come to us and talk about it. I know I didn't feel like I could do that. With my own daughter, what I've tried to do is leave our communication totally open. Like nothing's off limits. And I'm always honest with her. I'm honest with her about my history with food and how it happened and all the things and the struggles. And she talks to me about stuff I wouldn't dare talk to my mom about. There's an openness there. And I think when you're open to talk about things or show strong emotions without being punished for it, then you don't feel the need to push them down. And so that's the best thing that I can offer. Teach them nutrition. Pay attention to their habits with food. Do you see them like eating in secret? And I mean, there were things that I did. I always offered to cook so I could eat while I was cooking. I always offered to make all the other kids' lunches so I could have the most in mine and so I could hide some somewhere else in the cabinet. I mean, I mean that was early on. I was 7 years old. I was like sneaking and eating and stuff. If your kid's doing those things, they're using food in a way that's not intended. They are pushing down some sort of feelings. Maybe they're having anxiety. Maybe something's going on at school and they're just beginning to learn that food soothes that feeling. It's an opportunity when you notice those food things to say, something's going on with my kid. Let me figure out what it is in a non-judgmental way, in a calm way. Just ask questions. Yeah. So a lot of people think eating disorders come from being like fat shamed or eating. And I imagine they do at some point. But for a lot of us, I mean, I didn't know what an eating disorder was. It's just what I learned to do. I was wired that way. I found food as a solution and I used it. If I go back and I say, I take away the reasons why I did that, it was anxiety, it was trauma, it was things that if I could have talked about, I would not have needed to soothe. And so if we can avoid, you know, trauma for our kids, or if they do experience trauma, make it completely open to talk about. Allow them, just tell them, you can tell me anything. And I won't always approve of what you tell me, but I always want to know. I'll tell you if I disagree, but it's always going to be okay for you to tell me, you know, that.
Food plays such a vital role in the feelings of safety for children. Yeah. And I can't tell you how many times I've had a kid come into the group home that came from some of the most severe abuse cases you'd ever imagine. We'd find the kid sleeping in the closet with a pile of food next to him, raw packs of bacon and all kinds of stuff because it made them feel safe. And the binge eating can also do that. So if the kid's in an environment, for some reason, they don't feel safe, they're either, there's something going on inside the home or right. there's bullying at school.
Right.
You know, that can create it. Whatever is making a child not have that sense of security.
Right. Well, it's not about the food. I guess that's the point, right? There's something else. There's a problem that the child is trying to solve with food. And that's when it develops in childhood. So if you are open and aware and you see your child eating in a certain way, don't say, oh, no, don't eat that. You're going to get fat. That's like the worst possible thing. Don't put your kid on a diet. You can educate them about nutrition. You can buy healthy things, but never say, I'm putting you on a diet because you got chunky. And I see that every day in our keto kids group. There are parents that come on and say, my child's gotten chunky. And you can tell that they have had this conversation with the kid. Like, you're not going to have friends because you're overweight. And I'm horrified. So it's not, the weight is not the issue. The weight comes because of the food problem. Either they're eating really unhealthy stuff a lot, or there's a eating behavior there, or underlying medical condition. Either way, get interested. And that's the best thing you can do as a parent, I think, in my opinion. I don't know everything, but just in my experience.
Body image also plays a huge role on that. And that also can stem, especially for young ladies, that can stem a lot from childhood. Coming up, they look at the images in the magazines and think this is the way. It does the same thing for guys, but guys, it's a little bit different. We got to be the big beastie, hulky, muscular guy, you know. Right. Whereas women they feel they have to be this thin waif. You know, they've looked at the, I'm old, so Ziggy, you know, models and you know these toothpicks that walk the runway, and they think that is the ideal beauty, and they have to go for that. So how does that body image, how do you address that with people to get them to realize that being healthy is not necessarily that current society's ideal of beauty?
Yeah, well, I do think current society is more allowing of different body shapes. That could be a whole different other discussion about body positivity, because I'm for body positivity, but I'm also for health. But I think, you know, I think we have to pay attention to what our kids are exposed to. For me, I was more shaped by the fact that, so I was 11 when I started purging. And I think one of the reasons why is my friends were skinny as a rail, and I wasn't fat, but I was curvy. I already started, like, I had a little womanly shape at 11, and I didn't look like them. And I hated it. I did not embrace that at all. I wanted to look straight up and down like a stick. And I think that the bulimia was a little bit of a rebellion for me. Like, oh no, I'm going to make myself look like that. So I was more shaped by that than I was by media stuff. But I do talk to kids now, and they are very influenced by social media and by celebrity and everything else. And I have to try to help them understand that what they see is for the most part not real. Most of the time, pictures are a long way off from the first version that they were. You know, a lot of times it helps you know, they have a celebrity or something that they idolize, and you can find a picture of that celebrity online at the grocery store or whatever that somebody took, and you're like, look, they look like a regular person. This picture has clearly been like, there's no blemishes. There's no, you know, we have to teach them that what we see of people on social media is a snapshot of the very best possible version of them, that the rest of their life doesn't look like that. They don't walk away looking that way. It's a moment. They take 1,000 pictures to get one picture that's good enough. And then they take that picture and they alter it to death. Because we do have kids that are trying to achieve things that are not achievable without a lot of surgery or a lot of Photoshop. So we have to challenge the idea that it's real. And I also share about my own experiences with thinness. When I look back at that time in my life, I'm 5'10", and I was 115 pounds. I was skinny, really, really. I was gaunt, very skinny, and I didn't eat, you know, go 10 days at a time and not eat, or then I'd eat something really small and then still take laxatives. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible time, and I used to romanticize that time. I'd look back, and I would be like, oh, man, I just wish I was skinny like that again, and then again, when I started thinking clearly, I was like, what am I thinking? The things that I had to do to myself to be that weight. I was miserable. I was unhappy. Thinness did not equal happiness. And I think that people chase that too. They think when I get to this weight, then I'm going to be happy. And then they get to that weight and they're still unhappy. And that's why suicide happens. That's why rebounds happen. There's an unrealistic expectation attached to being thin, that thin equals happy. And there's too many examples of that not being true, even with myself. Like, I look back at pictures and I look miserable. Like, yeah, I was thin, but I was also like dead behind the eyes, you know? There's nothing magical about getting down to that skinny size that's going to change your life. It's not true. It's a lie that people believe, but I think we have to teach our kids that too.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And one other thing I want to get into before we do our closing questions, I always have a few questions at the end that are quick answer things, but you're from the accent, obviously, you know, from the country area, maybe the South or something, you know?
I'm in Southern Virginia.
Yeah. And we know that also culture can play a huge role in what we eat and a health of our diet. How challenging was it for you in the cultural area that you come from in Virginia? And I'm assuming like Mountain Dew is king and like, you know.
Sweet tea, Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
I'm show love down here. Like,
right. Absolutely. I'm originally from Ohio, so like that was the thing. It's like, you got a problem, eat this, you know, here you go. And all the sweets, the pastries that are baked out of there, the pies, you go to a truck stop down in the South and you'll find some of the best homemade baked pies that you'll find.
Oh, yeah,
so this stuff
them.
Is everywhere. Yeah. So how culturally was that a challenge in your changing of the diet or the people, maybe even some of the people that you work with? And it may not be just the Southern culture, but we're talking every culture has their food.
Right. Like I have a client who's Italian and she's like, I go to Italy. You want me to not eat pasta? You know, so there is like food is very tied to culture. I guess this would be on a few different levels. One, you have to be able to separate food from other events. We have turned every single thing into an eating event when that wasn't like, what are we here for? And I remind people of that. I ask them, why are you going to this thing? And they're like, well, I'm going to celebrate these two people getting married. I'm like, what does cake have to do with that other than that it's there? We get distracted by the cake and we miss the beauty of two people coming together and saying vows to each other forever. Like we have made all those Thanksgiving. The first thing you think when you think Thanksgiving is I need my fat pants. I mean, you see all that stuff. I'm going to eat until my stomach hurts. I mean, that's the plan. What about Thanksgiving? What about gratitude? And so I really challenge people to go back and say, why are you attending this event? Why are you going to see your mom? Is it to have her pies or do you want to sit and talk with her? And so to separate that thing that you've always done together, oh no, I really do want to go sit talk with my mom. And I have tasted her pie before. And I like to give people simple phrases to get themselves out of situations like that. We cover some of this stuff in our group too, but because we really talk about how do you practically live this way when you are sober in a world that's full of sugar and carbs. The best advice I can give is, don't say that much. Don't go in and announce that you're on a diet. Don't go in and talk about what you can't eat. Put food on your plate and sit down and eat it. That's number one. But number two, you say, it's, you know, somebody's trying to give you ice cream or whatever. You can just say, no, thanks, I'm full. And yeah, we do have food pushers down here sometimes. And I think the food pushers, sometimes they push because we're sitting there like, oh, I wish I could have that, but I'm on the stinking keto. And so they're trying to help us. They want to take care of us, but we create that ourselves because we're acting all deprived. But other food pushers do it because if what you're doing has gotten you well and healthy and you've eliminated all this stuff, it makes them feel like, could it be that I'm wrong? Could this stuff really be that unhealthy? And it even just my presence in places, I think, challenges people because they're like, they know I eat really high fat and meat all the time. They're like, how can that be true? And she's healthy if what I do is healthy. And it makes them shine a spotlight on themselves, and it can make people really uncomfortable. I try to just take off the pressure. That whole, you know, if somebody is like really trying to force food on you, because they'll feel better about what they're eating, I'll say, thanks, I'll take it home. And then I drop it in the trash. Or, you know, there's easy ways out. No, thanks, I'm full. But I also don't mind saying, you know, I gave up sugar and grains and I feel so amazing. I just can't, I know I'll feel bad if I eat that stuff again. It's just simple little things. Don't go in there and be like, hey, everybody, I'm keto. I can't have this, and I can't have this, and I can't have this. You go in there and eat what you can eat and keep your mouth shut about it. Don't engage in conversations about nutrition. They will always turn out bad, especially with family. But yeah, so just simple little ways to get out of it. But you have to go into a situation saying, I'm here to celebrate, to be around my family, to be thankful for the year that I've had, to be thankful that I'm free of compulsive eating. I'm not going to celebrate my gratitude for being free from an eating disorder by overeating. That makes no sense to me. So you have to sort that out before you go into the situation.
Yeah, I think that's a good point of separating the food away from celebration. Because I think part of our reason for food addictions is if we associate food to be the reward for everything and the problem solving element for when we have a problem as well. So it's tied into both areas. And with culture, every culture I've been around has their food things, and most of them will try to feed you. And maybe not always the best things, but they want you to keep eating because that's how they feel they're being. Yeah, or hospitality, you know, to a stranger.
I think it's important in that case to say you never have to offend anyone, but let's pretend you are severely, severely allergic to nuts. Even if the most hospitable, amazing person in the world tried to get you to eat nuts and they had all good intentions, you wouldn't eat them. So when you are addicted and you know eating that's going to turn on your addiction, you have to treat it the same way. Like, it's not going to hurt their feelings if you say, I have a really bad reaction to grains. And I do. My reaction is I swell to 309 pounds and I lose my mind. So saying to them what you would say if it was an allergy, because it is a poison to you, it poisons your life. You say, oh, thank you, but I have a really bad reaction when I have sugar. I really appreciate that thought, though. I mean, there's always a way out. You can't lose yourself to soothe somebody else. You have to think, this is my life, this is my health, and I know what happens when I eat this. I know. And I'm not going to do it, especially not just, you know, to soothe somebody else. There's always something you can say. I have a bad reaction to that. Nobody wants you to have a bad reaction to something in their house. They're thinking, you know, something's going to happen and they're going to have to call 911. You say, oh, no, I have a really terrible reaction to grains. They're going to not make you eat pasta. Like, give me a bowl of that fatty sauce. I'll eat it, like, with a spoon, but I can't have the grains. Great. They're happy to accommodate.
It's a good tactic to make sure that you get what you ask for in a restaurant, too, when you're keto.
Absolutely. They take you seriously. You don't talk about a diet. You say, I have a bad reaction to whatever it is. Yeah.
Because then they think lawsuit.
If you're on a diet.
Yeah. Because then they think lawsuit. All right. So I'd like to close out with some easy questions that are fairly short answer. And one of the first questions I ask, and it's in order to help people listening to find other resources and to do their deep dives. But I ask, who are your top five health heroes that helped get you started on this?
Yeah. Well, the first book I ever read was Keto Clarity by Jimmy Moore. And he's got a, you know, a wealth of information. It's written in a way that makes it super easy. I also love every YouTube video by Dr. Barry. It's so plain spoken that anybody can understand. It's it is facts, it is science, but it's spoken in a way that it's totally understandable. One of the first heroes I had, he's not around now, but his videos still are, is Butter Bob. Mm. There was a video, Butter Makes Your Pants Fall Off, and that's the first time I understood about cholesterol. And again, super, I tend to like people who can tell it in a way that anybody can get it, and I recommend them. I actually love Dr. Fong. Fasting is something that I am interested in and that I study. And so The Complete Guide to Fasting is one of my favorite things. And let's see what else. I really, there's a podcast that I love, Peak Human Podcast, which is awesome. And he has the reason I like that podcast, he has a lot of people on, and he shows studies. Like, he'll show a study that someone with an opposing view always uses, and he'll break down scientifically. Mm. It helps you stand up for yourself. When someone confronts you with this, you can say, actually, this is, you know, so I love that. Peak Human Podcast. Awesome.
I have to check that one out. That sounds like a cool one.
Yeah, I like it.
So my next question is, what are the top three foods you think everybody should avoid?
Sugar, any type of sugar, grains, and bad oils.
I like that question.
If that's all you change, and if that's all you change and you eat the other in unlimited quantity, you're still going to live longer.
I love asking that question because it shows a consensus, because it's almost always the same answer with everybody. So it shows a consensus. Like, everybody's agreeing that these are the bad things. Cool. What three foods do you think everybody should include in the diet?
Red meat, healthy animal fats, butter. Does there need to be a third one? I don't know. Maybe avocado. Avocado is pretty awesome. So.
Yeah, there you go. The fourth one is, what major nutritional myth, if you could just get rid of it and get it out of the current dogma, what major nutritional myth do you want to eradicate?
Saturated fat being dangerous and causing heart attack, or so basically the lipid hypothesis, cholesterol, that whole deal. With that was the thing that would be life changing for the whole planet if we could get the truth out there.
Ansel gets no love on this podcast. All right, and so if you could change something about our health system today, what would you change?
I would change the education for medical professionals, include nutritional training. A lot of people think that their doctors are trained in nutrition, and they legitimately are not. They get about 8 hours of training in 12 years of school, and they're trained with the food pyramid. So we expect our doctors to know about nutrition. We ask them the questions. They like to know the answers, even if they don't know the answers. But they, because they are not trained in nutrition, they don't go to a nutritional treatment. They immediately go to a pill. And I would love to see them be trained in nutrition and have to try a nutritional approach before prescribing meds.
You know, when I was an EMT, they always said, take the, hold on, I sent my microphone going again.
I hear it.
Okay. So they always said, take the least invasive procedure before you go to the most invasive. Right. And it seems to be the opposite in the medical system.
Really does.
So that's been, it's been really fun having you on the show, and I really enjoyed it. And you are our first lady to have on the show. Woo-hoo! Which is really awesome.
Representing the ladies.
Yeah. I'm actually hoping to do a whole series on women's health and bringing in a lot of ladies to talk about that. Cool. Different aspects of women's health for the podcast.
I love it.
But I want to leave everybody with, if they want a chance to work with you, if they want a chance to talk to you, can you leave some contact information?
Sure. On Facebook or on Instagram, my name is Coach Jessica, and it's CoachJessica. I think the thing that has helped most people is if they Google my name, Jessica Reynolds, I've been on a bunch of podcasts, and every single one is different. We talk about different things, and each one has helped people in different ways. So I would encourage them to listen to the podcast. I do work for ketoevangelistcoaching.com. So they can reach me that way. But I really encourage listen to all the podcasts that you can, if food addiction might be a thing, or mental health issues, or if you've had electric shock therapy. People are usually so relieved to hear somebody talk about that. So it's all in there.
You also run, like you said, you run some groups on Facebook for coaching, yes, and things, so they can find you there as well. Yes. And what are those groups?
It's Food Addiction Recovery. That's also through Keto Evangelist Coaching. But again, if you come to Coach Jessica, you can find information about everything else there. On Instagram, awesome, in my bio, or on Facebook on my page. I post about every different thing that I offer and do. And I usually post all the podcasts there too. So just coming to one of the two pages is actually going to get you what you want.
Awesome. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap up the show. It's been great having you on. It really has. And awesome. I've enjoyed this conversation, because I think people are starting to talk about this stuff, but it's still very much a stigma in our society to speak about all the things that we talked about, whether it's the electroshock, the food addiction, or even how to work with your kids in nutrition. It's amazing the stigma that is around nutrition and kids. Maybe we'll have to bring you on again and talk about that. That would be awesome.
I should read some of the comments that I get sometimes on Clara's posts about, like, this is child abuse.
Yeah.
They're like, give her cookies. This is child abuse. Things like that. It's crazy. So I'd love to talk about that sometime.
Yeah, that would be awesome, because that would also probably make a really cool series as well, as doing nutrition about kids, mainly focused toward kids. All right. We're going to go ahead and close things out. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Fatty Joe Show. Be sure to leave a comment and subscribe. It helps the show reach more people. To support the show, as well as Carrie Brown and Yogi's work on the blog, Keto Recipe Development Masterclasses, and to gain access to private Facebook groups and other awards, go to patreon.com/thefattyjoeshow or patreon.com/Carrie Brown. Also, check out our Carrie Brown and Yogi Parker YouTube channel for video versions of the Fatty Joe Show, recipe videos, and more. Join our awesome community on the Facebook group, The Keto Kitchen with Carrie Brown and Yogi Parker, and check out our carriebrown.com website for recipes, blog posts, discounts, cookbooks, masterclasses, and other great stuff. Thank you so much.